The following content has been provided by New St. Andrews College in Moscow, Idaho. For more information, visit us online at www.nsa.edu.
So we are continuing our series of podcasts on Christ and economic liberty, and I want to talk a little bit about fair trade. That sounds wonderful. Who could be against it? Isn't everyone in favor of fair trade, and who could be supportive of unfair trade? Well, it all has to do with the labels and how you attach names to things. So when you're talking about free trade, when you're talking about free market economics, when you're talking about a free exchange of goods and a free setting of prices, etc., sooner or later, at least in recent years, someone's going to say, but what about this? What about the cheaters? What about the people who have an unfair advantage? So this additional factor has entered into the discussions. So take a cup of coffee. Do you make a point to buy fair trade coffee, or do you buy the cheapest coffee that is ground out of the peasants? Right. So going back to the lifeboat illustration that I used previously, which to recap, if you've got three men in a lifeboat and one of them swam to the boat with a sack full of goods, in that lifeboat scenario, at least provisionally, there is a zero-sum game. More for one of the inhabitants of the lifeboat means less for the others. So if he eats all the food, if he drinks all the water, then the others are going to starve or die of thirst or whatever. So more for him is less for them. But when they wash up on a desert island and they're there for some years, and one of the three is more industrious than the others, and his hut is nicer, and his shed is nicer, and his store of food is bigger, and so on, it's a different situation, because on the island, they can grow things, they can find things, they can develop things, they can build things, which means that it's no longer a zero-sum game. It's no longer a fixed supply of resources, supplies, and whatnot. So if we go back to that lifeboat illustration, suppose that one of the men swam to the boat with all the provisions that we assumed, but then another man stole it from him and then consumed it all. So one man brought water and supplies and everything to the boat, and someone else took it away from him and ate it all, drank it all. In this scenario, the theft is actual theft, not theft because there was a refusal to share when it was obviously called for. So it is one thing to call for free trade, fair trade, and it's quite another to say, and anybody can steal whatever they want, because that's not fair. And there's an exchange of goods, I suppose you might say, but it's not a freely entered into exchange of goods. Now, for many critics of the emerging global economic system, this is, for them, precisely what is happening. They think that certain nations are being deliberately impoverished, with millions slaughtered, in order that we might have cheap coffee and bananas. So we live down at the other end of the lifeboat. We shield our delicate eyes so that we might have plausible deniability. What do you mean? The bananas just show up at Safeway. What do you mean? The coffee is just here. I just go buy coffee. What's the big deal? Why are you making a big deal out of it? What they do is they say, well, the lifeboat is big, and so consequently, you can ignore all the oppression that's going on down at the other end. Now, if that is in fact the case, right? So let's say you've got a big economy, and somebody is, you know, down at one end of the town, you've got a bunch of pirates and Vikings who go on raids and steal a bunch of stuff. And then they come back and they sell it to you, and you're living high on the hog because of all this piracy. Then certainly, would a Christian have a problem with that? Yeah, a Christian ought not to be living off of stolen goods. So critics of the emerging global economic system assert that the injustice of our economic arrangements is not just simply unjust in some non-golden rule sort of way, but that it is flagrantly unjust and that our wealth is a straightforward function of a thuggish foreign policy. So if that we send in the Marines if our coffee prices are going to go too high, or we send in the Marines if our oil prices are going to go too high, we've got a cozy spot, and so we have a thuggish foreign policy to protect our consumption ethic. So first, let it be said that if this were actually happening, if that's actually the case, it would be terrible, and Christians should be the first to condemn it. In other words, it is possible for an economic system to be based on injustice, right? It is possible for an economic system to be based on injustice, and when that is manifestly the case, Christians should be opposed to every form of injustice, including economic injustice. If we send in the Marines to fetch our cheap coffee and we leave the country we got it from a smoking ruin behind us, well, who could be for that? You know, who's in favor of killing people so that you can have a nickel off of your cup of coffee or a dollar off? You know, so I think we should concede the principle that rape and pillage are bad. So if we are pillaging others, if we are ripping other people off, if we are doing that in order to get our low prices, then that's a problem. But Christians think about this differently than socialists do. Christians say that if the stealing produces the inequality, I am opposed to the stealing. If the stealing produces the inequality, then we stand against the stealing. The socialist says, if there is inequality, there must be stealing. There must be stealing here somewhere. If there's inequality, then there have to be Marines, whether or not we see them. If there's inequality, there has to be a rigged set of treaties or a rigged, you know, the robber barons, the coffee plantation owners, the global elites, they're pulling the strings behind the scenes, and it's unjust simply because of the fact of inequality. So Christians acknowledge that inequality might result from stealing, but the socialist believes that inequality is stealing. All right, so that there's a significant worldview divide there. But we do grant, Christians do grant, that when you see inequality, it might be the result of theft. It might be the result of injustice, but not automatically. Okay, so my response to such accusations about the global economic system is that generally I don't believe them. As a general rule, I don't believe them. But it's important to note at the outset that my lack of faith in these accusations is not because I hold that empires are incapable of tawdry behavior. They are certainly capable of tawdry behavior. The British Empire disgraced itself in the Boer War, and the United States has done the same kind of thing, and more than once. So I'm not saying that, oh no, America would never do it. No, America has done it. We've been guilty. Our hands are not clean. There are instances historically of injustices that we've perpetrated on smaller countries that that I would say that's objectionable, right? So if someone says, "Well, that sounds very noble, but you know, give me an example." Well, we stole the Panama Canal. Well, we built the Panama Canal, but we stole the land where it was going to be built, where it's going to be dug. And some people, I remember back when there was a big debate about the United States turning control of the Panama Canal over to Panama. That was a big thing. We stole the canal. We, you know, back in Teddy Roosevelt's day, we were guilty of thuggish behavior, and we ought to return the canal. We need to return the canal. The problem with that is we shouldn't return the canal to Panama because Panama helped us steal it. We needed to return the canal to Colombia. Right? So the Panamanians helped us do our dirty deed. And, you know, one thief can't, 50 years after the fact or whenever it was, turn to the other thief and say, I'm feeling bad about that bank job that we pulled. Let me give you the, you know, let me give you half the money. If we were really sorry, we ought to return the canal and the whole thing back to the country we stole it from. Well, but the point is, yes, big countries, the United States included, are capable of acting in their economic self-interest in ways that are ungodly, unjust, and unrighteous. And so Christians should object to that when it happens. So this is not the United States is clean and pure no matter what. That's not the issue. When that kind of thing happens, we need an Ambrose to rebuke Theodosius, the Emperor Theodosius. And I would hope that I would support such a courageous churchman who was rebuking the emperor. And I would hope that I would be such a courageous churchman, willing to rebuke the emperor, even if what was being done was highly popular. So when it comes to, those bananas are they've got blood on them, or those cantaloupes, that, you know, that's a bloody mess, or that coffee, that's a problem. My lack of faith in these contemporary Michael Moore style accusations is based on three basic observations, and I'll make these observations and a few comments, and then we'll leave it there for the day. The first one: those who make those accusations, those who make accusations like this, what we're doing with coffee is outrageous, what we're doing with the produce is outrageous, and so forth, are almost universally in favor of domestic outrages, like our legalized abortion carnage or sodomite marriages. They can't read the big E on the ethical eye chart, so why should I ask them to have a try at the bottom line? Right? I believe they are ethical fools, and so I don't trust their moral judgments. Isaiah 5:20, woe to those who call good evil and evil good, substitute light for darkness, and so on. So if someone says, I believe in abortion on demand domestically, why should I believe anything he says? Why should I accept anything? Because admit, you know, if you are talking about two countries, and you're talking about one of the major exports, and you're talking about hundreds of farmers, and you're talking about many, many contracts, and you're talking about, at the very least, you've got a complicated situation. If someone said this was a ripoff or this is a problem, it might be a problem, but at the bare minimum, it's a complicated problem, and you need wise men to work through it and sort it out. And I would exclude, so if we're having a trial where we're, you know, where we have some banana plantation guy on trial, or we've got Chiquita Bananas on trial, or we've got Starbucks on trial, we've got them on trial over the coffee or whatever it is, and I'm one of the attorneys, and I'm letting people sit on the jury or excluding them from the jury, if I've got a very complicated ethical problem, I want to exclude from the jury anybody who thinks it's all right to cut up a baby. If you think it's all right to cut up a baby, I don't want to hear from you. I'm not interested. So because dismembering a baby in the name of constitutional liberty is not a complicated issue. That's a straightforward issue of killing someone because they're inconvenient. It's a very simple problem. And if you can't handle the simple ethical problem, then why should we trust you on these complex ones? So that's the first thing. The second objection is that these critics demonstrate in numerous ways that they don't understand basic economics. their heart is in charge of their head. For example, if minimum wage laws make them feel good in their heart, then they will opt for the feel-good move every time. Never mind that minimum wage laws price the poorest of the poor out of the market. Okay, so are there people in town who are willing to work for work all day, and the labor that, let's say, because of poor education or limited abilities or the economy of the region, all they're able to do is sweep out a warehouse. You know, that's what they can do. And so somebody hires them at $7 an hour to sweep out the warehouse. Now, when a man hires someone to sweep out a warehouse, that means it's worth to that owner $7 an hour to have the warehouse swept out. At some point, let's say $100 an hour, it is no longer worth it for the owner to have the warehouse swept out. I don't want to pay $100 an hour to have a clean warehouse. I'm willing to pay $7 an hour. I'm not willing to pay $100 an hour. We all know what this is like. I'm pointing to nothing more than a cost-benefit analysis. Whenever you're standing in a bookstore saying, should I buy this or should I not? It's $25. I'm not sure. I really want it. You're going back and forth in your mind. Is this product in front of me worth this amount of money that they're asking me? And you go back and forth. And of course, if you flipped it over and discovered that the book was on sale and it was half the price you thought, you're going to buy it, right? If you flip the book over again and discover that the sale ended yesterday and the book is back up to its original price, which is $10 more than the one you were stumbling at, you're saying, no, I'm not going to buy it. I'm not going to buy it. We make decisions based on that kind of economic calculus. Now, owners of warehouses do the same thing. They make decisions on whether or not that is worth it to me. It's worth it to me to pay $7 an hour to have the warehouse swept out. Now, if I've got someone of limited means and limited abilities, and he's sweeping out the warehouse every evening for $7 an hour, happily, and then some do-gooding economic reformers come in and get the city council to jack up the minimum wage to $15 an hour, what just happened? What just happened is that poor guy loses his job. It's no longer worth it to the warehouse owner to employ him. I'll make do with something else. I'll have the employees who are already on staff sweep it out real quick. No, that's not worth it. And so what you've just done is you took the poorest of the poor and you priced him out of the market. His services are worth something under $15 an hour. And you just made it impossible for someone like that to be hired or to be hired lawfully. So minimum wage laws price the poorest of the poor out of the market. They would rather feel good about legislation than actually do good for poor people. This is because they are sentimentalists, and feeling good always trumps doing good. Feeling good for them always trumps doing good. And the people who are calling for fair trade are people who are generally in this category. They are economically illiterate. They do not know how an economy works. They do not know how payrolls work. They do not know how wages work. They just don't know. And then the third reason for having a concern or rejecting these sorts of accusations is the people who are making the accusations do not teach the rich in this present world to do what the Bible expressly teaches the rich to do. Their solutions are ad hoc, and they wander away from the text at the first opportunity. What I mean by ad hoc is this. They say, well, I think rich people should pay their fair share. That sounds good, right? And I would say, okay, good. What is that fair share? What's the percentage? What percentage will the rich, when they get to that percentage, when will you be quiet? when will you be done demanding more? Well, the answer is there is no set line. There is no set definition of fair share. What the Apostle Paul says in 1 Timothy 6, he tells Timothy to instruct those who are rich in this present world not to set their hope on riches. All right, don't worship mammon, but rather trust in God, who gives us all good things liberally in order to enjoy. And it says instruct them to be generous and willing to share. All right, so those who are well off in this world should be instructed to overflow. They should be instructed, if they're Christians, to be generous and overflowing and giving to others. They're not to serve mammon instead of God. But it says that God, in 1 Timothy 6, it says God gives us all things for us. God gives all things richly for us to enjoy. And so I would reject the opponents of market-priced coffee, market-priced produce, market-priced anything. The opponents of this is, oh, that's too expensive. I would say, look, you are in favor of outrages, ethical outrages that are far worse than this, and so why should we trust you? Secondly, on the question of economics, you haven't demonstrated a basic competence in the field. And thirdly, you're not willing to tell the rich to do what the Bible tells the rich to do.
New St. Andrew's College thanks you for listening.